Chapter 22 Hearings. On February 17, 1970, the same day the Senate Foreign Relations Committee began hearing testimony on U.S. government pacification policy in South Vietnam, Robert Kaiser reported that some people were calling Phoenix an instrument of mass political murder, sort of Vietnamese Murder Incorporated. Coming on top of the Green Beret murder case and reports about the My Lai massacre, sensational reports like Kaiser's formed a disturbing pattern, one suggesting that terror and political repression were official policies of the U.S. government. The senators wanted to know if that was true. William Colby was willing to put their minds at ease. Colby's strategy was outlined in State Department Telegram 024391, dated February 17, 1970, which says in part, "We believe the line of questioning attempting to establish the Phoenix program as an assassination program can be successfully blunted by repeated assertions regarding U.S. GVN policies, coupled with admissions of incidents of abuses." Using this approach, Colby alternately confounded and assuaged his congressional challengers by saying, "I will not pretend to say that no one has been wrongfully killed there." Colby came across as a decent, honest, fallible human being. He did not admit premeditated murder, but the master of the art of the possible did lay a credible foundation for the plausible fictions that followed. Making his job easier were the absence of witnesses who might contradict his claims, the fact that lurid reports of Phoenix abuses were often derived from secondhand sources and were replete with melodramatic language which detracted from their reliability, and the lack of background information available to the senators. A blank slate Colby used to his advantage early in the proceedings by introducing a carefully prepared statement for the record on the Phung Hoang program, which defined Phoenix not as a broad symbol of contra-coup, but in the context of the Cords bureaucracy. Phoenix in this manifestation was merely a block in an organizational chart, a box on a shelf with a warning label listing all its dangerous ingredients, not a concept of counterterror. Colby defined Phoenix as an internal security program designed to protect the people from communist terrorism, and by defining the people apart from the VCI as the object of VCI terror and as voluntarily participating in the program, he established a moral imperative for Phoenix. Next, he established a legal basis for the program. Phoenix, Colby said, was designed to single out key personnel for primary attention. The key people were guilty of crimes against national security and were subject to judicial proceedings in military courts and to administrative detention under emergency powers, similar to those used in Malaya, Kenya, and the Philippines. He cited the preamble to Minister of Interior Circular 757, which said, "Government policy is to completely eliminate the VCI by capturing as many as possible, while the lenient rehabilitation policy aims at releasing as many as possible." He did not mention that the circular was not understood or properly applied, nor did he mention the existence of province interrogation centers, or that the CIA asset, the Deputy Chief for Security, managed the affairs of the Province Security Committee, or that mandatory sentencing was an official policy that meant 2 years in Tung Hiep, Chihua, Tudok, or Con Son prison. The laws were on the books. Did it matter that they were not enforced? Colby then proceeded to abstract fact from form. Citing Directive 044 of March 1969, he described the PRU as part of the National Police. However, in order to protect an ongoing covert action, he neglected to mention, as Colonel Pappy Greaves explained, that the PRU were supposed to voluntarily enter the police, province by province, man by man. But none of them ever did. Meanwhile, in early 1970, National Police Chief Tran Van Hai gave Field Police Chief Nguyen Van Dai oversight of the PRU. "To be a force," writes Colonel Dai, "I must accept PRU in the support division, which originally consisted of the field and marine police forces." But, Dai adds, he only monitored the PRU, while Major Lang actually commanded them under the supervision of Tucker Gugelman. "I did not have any major problems between NPFF and PRU," Dai continues. "Only myself and the American PRU advisors had a misunderstanding, and the PRU advisors accused me of having anti-American spirit." According to Pappy Greaves, the trouble between Dai and Gugelman developed when Dai inspected a company of PRU in One Corps and found they were short 400 tons of plastique. They couldn't account for a number of M16s and pistols either, Greaves revealed. I said, Dai, where did they go? He said, Colonel, there's only one place they could go. This again is the problem of the company, Greaves sighed. No accountability out of Saigon. Or in Washington. As reported at the hearings, the CIA funded the PRU in 1969 at a cost of more than $5 million and, Colby said, plans are in progress for the transition of the PRU to full GVN funding and support. In 1970, the CIA funded the PRU at an increased cost of more than $6 million. Having defined Phoenix as moral, popular, and legal, Colby took questions from the senators, some of whom used the opportunity to promote themselves. Others tried to get at the truth. For example, Tennessee Senator Albert Gore asked Colby to explain the difference between the Viet Cong terror efforts against the political infrastructure of the Saigon government, on the one hand, and the counterterror program of the GVN against the political infrastructure of their opposition, the NLF. Dodging the question, Colby said, there is no longer a counterterror effort. One had existed a few years earlier, for about 6 months to a year, but, he said, he had stopped it because they did some unfortunate things. After some verbal jousting, Gore asked Colby, what were the goals of the Phoenix program when it was, by your terms, a counterterror program? Colby, to capture, rally, or kill members of the enemy apparatus. Gore, as I understand your answer, the goals are the same. You used identically the same words, capture, rally, or kill. I do not quite get either a distinction or a difference. Colby, the difference was that at the time there were these special groups which were not included in the normal government structure. Since that time, this has been more and more integrated into the normal government structure and correspondingly conducted under the government's rules of behavior. Was it really? In her article, The CIA's Hired Killers, Georgianne Geyer tells how, in the absence of an American or South Vietnamese ideology, it was said in the early days, why not borrow the most workable tenets of the enemies? After all, she quotes Frank Scotton as saying, they stole the atomic bomb secrets and all from us. And so, Geyer writes, Scotton and a few other Americans started a counter-guerrilla movement in northern Quang Ngai province. Terror and assassination were included in their bag of tricks. At one point, USIS printed 50,000 leaflets showing sinister black eyes. These were left on bodies after assassination or even, our terrorists are playful, nailed to doors to make people think they were marked for future efforts. But, Geyer goes on, whereas Scotton's original counter-guerrillas were both assassins in the night and goodwill organizers of the people, the PRUs are almost exclusively assassins in the night. Their emphasis of late, she writes, has been to murder, kidnap, terrorize, or otherwise forcibly eliminate the civilian leadership of the other side. In one village, a VC tax collector will be assassinated in his bed in the night. In another, wanted posters will be put up for a VC leader, offering a reward to try to persuade his friends to turn him in. The PRU may also drop down from helicopters and terrorize whole villages, in the hope that they will be frightened to deal with the VC in the future. Furthermore, the PRUs are excellent torturers. Torture has now become so indiscriminately used that the VC warned their men to beware of any released prisoner if he has not been tortured. Sometimes we have to kill one suspect to get another to talk, Geyer quotes a PRU advisor as saying. Another PRU advisor told her that he ate supper with his PRUs on the hearts and livers of their slain enemies. Another one said, I've been doing this for 22 years all over the world. He cited Egypt when Nasser was coming to power and the Congo when we were trying to get rid of Chombe, writes Geyer about the PRU advisor. His job, like that of many Americans in South Vietnam, was terror. And she calls American PRU advisors really the leaders, a view that contrasted with Colby's claim that Americans were limited to advice and assistance. As for the instructors who taught Francis Reitmeier how to manage PRU, Colby said, we have some rather direct instructions to our people as to their behavior in Vietnam. Colby was referring to an October 15, 1969 memo sent to the Phoenix staff and forwarded for inclusion in the training of Phung Hoang advisors in Vietnam and at Fort Holabird. The memo stated that U.S. personnel are under the same legal and moral constraints with respect to operations under the Fung Hong program as with respect to military operations against enemy units in the field. The final word on Phoenix policy was contained in MACV Directive 525-36, issued on May 18, 1970. Noting the unlawful status of members of the VCI, MACV Directive 525-36 cites the desirability of obtaining these targeted individuals alive and of using intelligent and lawful methods of interrogation to obtain the truth. It says that Phoenix advisors were specifically unauthorized to engage in assassination, and that if they were to come in contact with activities conducted by Vietnamese, never Americans, which do not meet the standards of land warfare, they were not to participate further, but were expected to make their objections of this kind of behavior known to the Vietnamese conducting them, and expected to report the circumstances to the next higher U.S. authority. The directive closes by saying that if an individual finds the police-type activities of the Phoenix program repugnant to him, on his application, he can be reassigned from the program without prejudice. In response to the article by Geyer, which focused attention on the PRU and the issue of terror, and in defense of William Colby, his patron John Vann said, "There is always a tendency to report extremes, but when those exceptions are used by people who are in basic disagreement with the policy in Vietnam as a means of criticizing the effort, they are taken out of context. They in no way reflect anything that is normal." Kentucky Senator Sherman Cooper asked Vann, "Is the Phoenix organization a counterterror organization?" Vann replied, "The counterterrorist organization bore and bears no resemblance at all to Phoenix." Cooper, "Is the U.S. involved in any way in carrying out what can be called a terrorist activity?" Vann, "Well, the answer very shortly, sir, is no, we do not." Compare Vann's statement with that made by Charlie Yothers, the CIA's chief of operations in OneCorps in 1970. "Sure, we got involved in assassinations. That's what PRU were set up for, assassination. I'm sure the word never appeared in any outlines or policy directives, but what else do you call a targeted kill?" According to Tully Akampora, Phoenix was a two-tiered program, with the PRU working against terrorists on the tactical level and the CIO operating above that on strategic affairs. This aspect of Phoenix was addressed by New Jersey Senator Clifford Case when he asked William Colby if Phoenix might be used by ambitious politicians against their political opponents, not the Viet Cong at all. Colby, "It is our impression that this is not being used substantially for internal political purposes. I have heard the President and Prime Minister on many occasions give strong directions that the focus is on the Viet Cong and that it is not to be used for other purposes." Picking up on this line of questioning, Committee Chairman William Fulbright asked Colby, "Where is Mr. Zhu, the man who ran second in the last election?" When Colby said, "Mr. Zhu is in Chi Hoa jail in Saigon," Fulbright asked him to reconcile that with your statement of the very objective view of the Prime Minister. Colby replied that Truong Dinh Zhu was not arrested under the Phoenix program. Zhu was arrested under Article 4, which made it a crime to propose the formation of a coalition government with the communists. Fulbright, "But you say they are giving instructions to be so careful not to use the program for political purposes when Tu himself has put a man in prison for no other crime that we know of than that he ran second to him in the elections." At that point, Senator Case came to Colby's rescue saying, "I think that just perhaps suggests this is a privilege reserved for higher officials." But the point had been made. If Phoenix were to be judged by the behavior, not the stated policies of Tu's administration, then it was an instrument of political repression. Moreover, as indicated in a letter from Tran Nhoc Chau to Senator Fulbright, political repression in South Vietnam was carried out with a tacit approval of the U.S. government. In his letter to Fulbright, which was inserted into the record of the hearings, Chau claimed that his contacts with his brother had been authorized by, among others, William Colby, Ev Bumgartner, Tom Donahue, Stu Methven, John O'Reilly, Gordon Jorgensen, and John Vann, who instructed Chau not to inform Tu of his contacts with Hien. Chau wrote, "Present political persecution of me is consequence of combined action taken by U.S. officials and CIA and Vietnamese officials in an attempt to sabotage Vietnamese and communist direct talks for peace settlement." In February 1970, Chau was sentenced to 20 years in jail. In May 1970, writes Professor Huey, the Supreme Court rendered a judgment stating that Chau's arrest and condemnation were unconstitutional. Despite this judgment, Tu refused to free Chau. What happened to Chau and Zhu proved that stated policy in South Vietnam was ignored in reality. Likewise, attempts to portray Phoenix as legal and moral were transparent public relations gimmicks meant to buy time while Tu consolidated power before the ceasefire. To ensure Tu's internal security, CIA officers were willing to betray their assets, and this capacity for treachery and deceit is what really defined American policy in regard to Phoenix, the PRU, and the war in general. What the Senate concluded, however, was only that diametrically opposed views on Phoenix existed. The official line advanced by William Colby portrayed Phoenix as imperfectly executed, but legal, moral, and popular. The other view, articulated by Senator Fulbright, was that Phoenix was a program for the assassination of civilian leaders, but that was not proven. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee may have been confused by last week's testimony on Operation Phoenix, observed Tom Buckley. The problem, he explained, is one of definition. Unable to decide which definition was correct, the press tended to characterize Phoenix as an absurdity. In a February 18, 1970 article in the New York Times, James Sturba said that the program appears more notorious for inefficiency, corruption, and bungling than for terror. If someone decided to make a movie about Phoenix, the lead would be more a Gomer Pyle than a John Wayne. Playing on the notion that the Vietnamese, too, were too corrupt and too stupid to be evil, Tom Buckley wrote that the PRU were quicker to take the money, get drunk, and go off on their own extortion and robbery operations than they were to sweep out into the dangerous boondocks. Hardly a description of what Jim Ward called the finest fighting force in Vietnam. But for Buckley and Sturba, there was no motive behind the madness. Phoenix was a comedy of errors, dopey disguises, and mistaken identities. There was nothing tragic in their depictions. Even the people directing the show were caricatures subject to ridicule. So it was that Phoenix began sinking into a morass of contradictions which seemed to reflect the intensely human, moral ambiguity of the Vietnam War itself. Even the dead-end debate between Colby and Fulbright mocked America's babbling, hilarious schizophrenia. Whom to believe? 20 years later, the facts speak for themselves. When Fulbright asked Colby if cash incentives were offered to Vietnamese for neutralizations, Colby said no. 6 months later, the deputy director of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Frank Clay, sent a memo, JCSM 34-70, to Defense Secretary Melvin Laird, noting that General Abrams had recommended an incentive program to foster greater neutralization achievement. One of the more significant Phoenix documents, Clay's memo, enumerated the Defense Department's major concerns regarding Phoenix: the National Identity and Registration Program, information support of Phoenix, inadequacy of prison space, surveillance of released VCI, Phung Hoang leadership, and exchange of intelligence. These six concerns, notably, derived from a survey conducted by Robert Comer in June 1970. Upon arriving in Turkey as U.S. ambassador, Comer had been dogged by demonstrators charging him with war crimes. Consequently, he resigned his post even before his nomination was confirmed by the Senate. Seeking vindication, he hired on with Rand, returned to Saigon, and wrote a scathing report called The Phung Hoang Fiasco. In it, Comer says, "As the military war winds down and the conflict assumes a more politico-subversive character, a much more sophisticated and intensive effort to destroy the VCI becomes well-nigh indispensable to a satisfactory outcome." The former champion of quotas rails against fakery, charging that half the kills are falsely listed as VCI just to meet Phung Hoang goals. He cites instances where we may have as many as 10 or 12 dossiers on the same man, and he complains that each agency still keeps its own files. Special branch is grossly overstaffed with poor quality results. The field police are a flop as the action arm of Phung Hoang. And as for the PRU, Comer writes that everywhere their effectiveness is apparently declining greatly. Comer is especially critical of the Vietnamese. In Three Corps, fully half the province chiefs don't really support Phung Hoang, he writes, and in Two Corps, Lu Lan gives only lip service. Comer names Lieutenant Colonel Thiep, who replaced Loi Nguyen Tan, who took command of Chi Hoa prison, as the senior full-time Phung Hoang officer, then adds contemptuously that Tiep's incompetent boss Colonel Song is apparently being kicked upstairs. As I put it bluntly to Tu and Kim, Comer says, there are 65 generals in RVNAF. How come only a LTC to run Feng Huang? Basically, Comer's anger stemmed from Tu's decision to transfer the central Feng Huang permanent office from the Prime Minister's office to the National Police Directorate as a separate block. Noting that the Feng Huang block is completely separate from the key special branch block, Comer argues that the central Feng Huang permanent committee had been downgraded. He calls the transfer a case where one of the most crucial of all current GVN priority missions is given to one of the weakest and least effective GVN agencies, the National Police. In a May 3, 1970 telegram to the Secretary of State, Ambassador Ellsworth Bunker explained that Feng Huang was being transferred from Prime Minister Kim's office to the National Police to move it toward Vietnamization and improve its overall operations. Noting that the U.S. advisory position on this question has been established through coordination between MACV Cords, OSA, and Embassy. Bunker concludes by stating his belief that the most important contribution National Police can make to future Vietnam lies in vigorous and proper execution of Phung Huang program against Viet Cong infrastructure. Case closed. As compensation for the transfer, Comer proposed getting the best young, hard-driving major general to be found, Phung or Minh of CMD, and make him minister or vice minister of interior to give him status. Other reforms Comer suggests: to increase reward money, to go after the five best dossiers, and to concentrate efforts in eight provinces where well over half the estimated VCI are concentrated. The provinces were Quang Nam, Quang Tinh, and Quang Ngai in one corps, Binh Dinh in two corps, and Kien Hoa, Vinh Long, Vinh Binh, and Dinh Tuong, where Comer found the only Phung Huang program worthy of the name, in four corps. Summarizing, Comer writes, "For better or worse, CIA produced the only experienced hands who were really good at the game. If I couldn't think of a better solution, I'd transfer operational control over the whole business to OSA, Office of Special Assistant, cover designation for the CIA." But Bunker, in his May 3, 1970 telegram, had already nixed that idea. Integration into special police would complicate important public information aspects of program, he said, and produce complications to U.S. advisory element. When VCI reduced to manageable level, he said, turning Phoenix over to the special branch could be reviewed. In any event, the VC turn to protracted war reemphasizes necessity of Phung Huang effort against infrastructure during coming year, and is of higher priority in Vietnam today than civil law enforcement as contribution to Vietnamization. 3 years into the program, the Phoenix Brain Trust was back on square one, wondering, as Evan Parker had recommended, if it should focus its efforts not on legions of low-level VCI, but on the big fish, and, as Parker had also observed, if CIA special branch advisors were not already doing the job. Having come full circle, Comer finally realized that the special branch and its U.S. advisors seemed to run an almost completely separate operation. Usually, when I asked why no fingerprints and dossiers, I was told they were over in the special branch office in the PIC. Comer was right. Phoenix was a fiasco, not just because the CIA had decided to hide behind it for public information purposes. The notion that reporting formats and quotas as management tools could supplant 1,000 years of culture and 40 years of communist political development at the village level was simply a false premise. Yes, Phoenix was a fiasco. It had become unmanageable, and it encouraged the most outrageous abuses. But because it had become of higher priority than civil law enforcement, it was also a fiasco with tragic, not comic, consequences. By 1970, an armistice was inevitable, and Phoenix had become the vehicle by which America was going to transfer responsibility for internal security to the Vietnamese. As a result, General Abrams asked that it be made clear to all U.S. and RVN agencies contributing to the Phung Huang Phoenix program that the objective of neutralizing the infrastructure is equal in priority to the objectives of tactical operations. As a way of going after strategic VCI targets, the big fish running COSVN, and as a way of protecting Phoenix from penetration by enemy agents, Abrams also asked that consultation be initiated with the Attorney General to secure a team of 2 or 3 FBI counterespionage experts to be sent to the RVN for the specific purpose of providing recommendations for the neutralization of important national-level members of the VCI. Meanwhile, in Washington, General Clay advocated increased attention on the DIOCCs, the cutting edge of Phoenix, because the district and village-level infrastructure remains the key element in the enemy plan to subvert the government, and continues to produce the major threat against GVN efforts to consolidate pacification gains made in the past 18 months. Clay also noted that Fung Huang leadership is being improved by recognizing and expanding the prominence of the role of the special police in the functioning of the DIOCC. But in order to mount an attack against the VCI, the U.S. Army needed to gain access to special branch files in the DIOCCs. So, in February 1970, a third Standard Operating Procedure Manual was issued with instructions on how to use the ultimate Phoenix management tool, the VCI Target Folder. As stated in the Fung Huang Advisor Handbook, preparation of target folders is the foundation from which successful operations can be run and sentencing be assured by province security committees. Target folders also served a public information function by allowing William Colby to say that our first step was to make sure that the intelligence we gathered on the VCI was accurate, and for this we set up standards and procedures by which to weed out the faults from the correct information. Target folders were specifically designed to help Phoenix advisors focus on high-level VCI. Divided in two, a target folder contained biographical data on the left side and operational information on the right, in which the suspect's habits, contacts, schedule, and modus operandi were recorded, along with captured documents and other evidence. The folder was the responsibility of the special branch case handler in the DIOCC, although a source on the suspect might be handled by another agency. Each special branch case handler was required to maintain 10 People's Intelligence Organization, PIO, cells, each consisting of 3 agents, in each hamlet in his area of operations. As stated in the third Standard Operating Procedure Manual, the tracking of a VCI suspect began when an informant reported someone making suspicious utterances or spreading false rumors. As more and more sources informed on a suspect, he or she graduated from Blacklist D to C to B, then finally to Blacklist A, most wanted, at which point the VCI suspect was targeted for neutralization and an operation mounted. The folder was sent to the PIC while the suspect was being interrogated and to the Province Security Committee to assure proper sentencing. In order to help special branch case handlers gather the precise evidence a security committee needed for quick convictions, training programs were started in each corps, where the case handlers were taught how to maintain target folders, 100,000 copies of which the Phoenix Directorate prepared and distributed in August 1970. To assure proper target folder maintenance, the Army also assigned a counterintelligence-trained enlisted man to each DIOCC. In 1970, 185 of these counterintelligence specialists graduated from the Phoenix Coordinator's Orientation Course. They acted as liaison among the PIC, DIOCC, and PIOCC. In addition, a third officer was added to each PIOCC staff to coordinate with Chiu Hoi and field police, and in an effort to upgrade the status of Phoenix coordinators vis-a-vis the CIA's special branch advisors, region slots were filled by full colonels, with majors in PIOCCs and captains in DIOCCs. However, cooperation between province Phoenix coordinators and CIA province officers rarely occurred. A survey of each corps in November 1970 produced these results. One corps reported that certain member agencies in the DIOCCs have a wealth of knowledge and information which had hitherto never been tapped. Two corps reported that professional jealousies and even distrust among agencies continue to impair progress. Three corps reported that support comes from only one or two of the agencies represented, while others tend to ignore results. Four corps reported that each GVN intelligence agency closely guards its information, thus making dossier construction difficult. The problem, not explicitly stated, was that CIA officers extracted from Phoenix by Ted Shackley and hidden away in embassy houses saw only liabilities in sharing their sources with amateurish Phoenix coordinators. Said Ed Bradley, "They had their relationship with the PIC. Many of them either participated in or observed or were close at hand during the interrogations, so they had first-hand output from it. Very few of them, however, ever went and put that in the PIOCC or in the DIOCC, which they were required to do by the procedures. What they really did," he complained, "was go out and get their own organization, the PRU, and run their own separate operations. It wasn't a special branch operation. It belonged to the province officer. So if he thought he had some intelligence that could be acted upon, the U.S. tendency was to act on it unilaterally. They might invite a few special branch people to go along, but the special branch might not accept the invitation. Then, if they caught somebody, they brought him back and turned him over to the special branch. They were so caught up in the mythology themselves, they'd say, "Hey, I'm running a Phoenix operation." Here, Ed Bradley chose to define Phoenix in its narrow organizational sense, as a division of cords with its own SOP, officers, and employees. But insofar as Phoenix is a symbol for the attack against the VCI, and insofar as the PICS and PRU were the foundation stones upon which Nelson Brigham built ISICS, the province officers were in fact running Phoenix operations. What is important to remember is that in order to achieve internal security in South Vietnam, America's war managers had to create and prolong an emergency which justified rule by secret decree and the imposition of a military dictatorship. And in order to gain the support of the American public in this venture, it was necessary for America's information managers to disguise the military dictatorship, which supported itself through corruption and political repression, as a bastion of Christian and democratic values besieged by demonic communists. In this context, Phoenix is the mask for the terror of the PICS and the PRU, and for the CIA's attempts at the political level to eliminate the opposition to us and to control the Vietnamese through our clients. Phoenix, in the conceptual sense, is all the programs it coordinated, as well as the public information aspects that concealed its purpose. All other definitions are merely intellectual jargon. The point, Ed Murphy reminded us, is that it was used in Vietnam, it was used in the United States, and it still is used in the United States.